We will now move on to our third case. Ms. Kelly and Mr. McGinnis, if you want to please unmute and turn your video on just so that we can make sure that we can hear you. Ms. Kelly, can you hear me okay?
I can, Your Honor.
And are you able to see the clock in the marshal screen?
I am.
And then Mr. McGinnis, can you hear me okay?
Yes, Your Honor.
And are you able to see the clock in the marshal screen?
Yes, I am.
All right. Thank you both for being here and welcome to the Court of Appeals. I'm Judge Chappal Harris, and with me today are Judges Luis Bjorkman and Diane Bradfold. I want to start by thanking you for your patience. We did have some technical difficulties in the previous case, which pushed the start time of your case back. So I do appreciate you being patient and flexible. Just a couple of comments. Please note that this is being recorded. So I do ask that at the beginning of each of your arguments that you do state your name for the record. In addition, please note that while we do enjoy speaking with you, the time does go fast. So please note the time in the screen. Finally, each of you will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, with the appellant getting an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. With that, Mr. McGinnis, as you first and foremost, I am going to call the case. That is court file A241629, the state of Minnesota versus Abdirahman Muhammad Abdi. Mr. McGinnis, you can begin your argument when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Joseph McGinnis. I represent Abdirahman Abdi in this case. Mr. Abdi was a chronically homeless, mentally ill, and a Somali refugee who was accused of shoplifting food and clothing from a Walmart. He was charged with third-degree burglary, and he was put on trial twice for that charge, with nearly 3 years separating those two trials. Now, I'm requesting that this court reverse Mr. Abdi's conviction because his right to not be placed twice in jeopardy was violated. And it was violated in two ways in this case. First, it was violated because the declaration of the mistrial that occurred in the first trial was made without any manifest necessity, and it was made against Mr. Abdi's consent or acquiescence. His attorney proposed a viable alternative to the mistrial, and the court, without stating why, sua sponte declared the mistrial. And secondly, even regardless of consent or acquiescence, that mistrial was declared because of the state's conduct in the case. So the state's repeated misconduct and failure to prepare their witnesses to testify, and introduction of evidence that violated a court order, court pretrial order, caused the court to declare that mistrial. And so it's that intentional conduct that occurred resulting in a mistrial that that requires reversal as well.
Counsel, I do note as part of your first argument, you indicated that Mr. Abdi presented an alternative, that being that the state could question the officer and then there would be a curative instruction. And you indicate that the court didn't address that. But as I read the transcript, it seems to me that the court did address it and indicated that, in essence, she didn't believe that the officer would be able to testify, I guess, truthfully in the way that Mr. Abdi wanted. Why isn't that sufficient?
Because she after defense counsel raises the alternative, she does bring up that concern, and she turns to the prosecutor with that concern and asks the prosecutor, Do you agree? Could the officer testify accurately, based on what defense counsel is proposing? And the prosecutor says that, in fact, the officer can. And so it's at that point where both defense counsel and the prosecutor have said this is not going to cause this, this alternative does not require the officer to lie or to misstate the facts or anything like that. It is absolutely true that the officers in that moment were investigating the Walmart shoplifting and not the Cashwise shoplifting. And so it would have been absolutely accurate to ask that follow-up clarifying question and move forward. And then when the judge goes on to make, following the comments of the prosecutor, the judge goes on and says, I'm declaring a mistrial. But unlike, the cases like State v. Long, where there's a real, where the judge really analyzes, okay, this would be the impact of letting in the statement. This would be the impact of exclusion. There's none of that weighing, and there's none of the explanation. The judge hears that from the prosecutor, there's no problem with this alternative. And then the judge says, well, there's prejudice, but there's no analysis of the prejudice.
Well, but don't, to be fair to the district court, I mean, we have to look at the broader context, right? I mean, there had been pretrial motions about, letting what information about why he was trespass, why your client was trespassed from the Walmart, the, kind of the extent of that. And I think defense counsel, rightly so, was, drew the line between we don't want prior bad act evidence coming in versus jury having a right to know that he was trespassed, and that's how we get to burglary. And then we have the prior testimony that elicited not only objections from defense counsel, but two different requests for a mistrial. I mean, don't we have to look at all of the context and say, the court really did consider and maybe just sort of looked at the, it's sort of like a cumulative error sort of analysis. It wasn't simply this last admission of a video that the district court was concerned about, correct?
I think, Your Honor, you are absolutely correct, and I think that the court is part of the problem is that the court is basing this decision on kind of this built up frustration with the prosecutor's repeated kind of repeated violations of the court's.
Well, it, or
And
said another way, I mean, the concern that the that in fact the kind of prior bad acts evidence that argue, seemingly wasn't related to because the shoplifting wasn't the focus of the trial, but certainly the notion that your client has numerous criminal conduct in the past. I mean, that was something the court was keenly aware of all through the trial, and it isn't really that the basis for the concern, not so much who brought the evidence forward, but that in fact your client could be prejudiced by it.
Well, there's the, I think the issue is that whereas in Long we had an in-depth discussion by the district court of why the evidence was prejudicial, here we don't have that. And here we have a situation where they're at the last when defense counsel proposes that alternative, they are at the last witness in this case. Defense counsel is about to get up and give his closing argument, is about to concede the shoplifting, which he essentially did in his opening statement. Defense counsel is about to do this. They're at the very end of trial. And, Mr. Abdi has a right to conclude this confrontation with the state in this moment. And it's, and the defense counsel had been dealing with some outbursts from Mr. Abdi during the trial. And so I think at that moment, the next day after he's made, all the, I certainly there's one mistrial motion on the record the first day of trial. The second day of trial, defense counsel does not make any motion for a mistrial, and there's no discussion by the court of why exactly would the prior mentions of shoplifting be prejudicial when the defense counsel is literally about to get up and say, yes, Mr. Abdi shoplifted, as was the defense in the second trial. But what we're really talking about is whether he understood the trespassing notice. And there's just not that is not making that's not creating a manifest necessity that we've seen in these other cases, like Long, where there's a discussion of, the court explaining this is a catch-22. I don't have any option to move forward because if I did option A, it would result in prejudice to the state if I exclude the statement, or option B, I would create prejudice to the defendant if I admit the statement. So we don't have that. We just have the court kind of, essentially wanting to sanction the prosecutor for the repeated violations of the of its order.
Well, counsel, you're indicating we don't have that. How do you respond, at least to transcript three, paragraphs 31 through 32, where the court talked about there's no objection to the video? Everyone agrees that this was after the morning. The court was very clear that I thought at this point that those three incidents had already happened, could be cured with an instruction, we could move forward. And defense counsel, you disagreed at that point. Quite frankly, you said that the jury was tainted. In essence, earlier in the morning, you indicated, or Abdi, Mr. Abdi indicated that based on those three previous kind of violations of the court order, that the jury was tainted. And the court indicated, now there's a fourth one. I'm trying to reconcile the argument that at number three, Mr. Abdi is indicating that the jury's tainted, and now when a fourth one happens, that taint disappeared somehow. Like, how do we? It seems to me the court did explain, or tell me why I'm wrong, that the court did explain that there was an argument that the jury is tainted after three. There's a fourth violation here, and now because of this fourth one, the court was clearly saying that I have a jury that's prejudiced, and there's nothing that we can do that would unring that bell.
Well, I would say that there's no explanation of what the taint is. So it can't just be the prosecutors violated my order. It has to be, and that has prejudiced Mr. Abdi. And there's no taint or prejudice to Mr. Abdi if his attorney is about to give up and tell the jury and has already told the jury essentially that the shoplifting happened. And what we're here to talk about is his language ability, and he didn't understand. So that lack of explanation of the taint is what's I think critical. And then in that moment, the judge is giving defense counsel, who true has previously made the motion, but the judge is giving the defense counsel every opportunity in that moment to renew the or to re-bring the mistrial motion. And defense counsel's not doing it. And I think that's a strategic decision. And it parallels Long, where defense counsel initially moves for a mistrial and then, can reflecting on the jury, reflecting on the evidence in the case, and talking to his client, withdraws that mistrial motion. And, there's no issue then. So I think it's a very similar situation. Defense counsel is sitting there. He knows he's going to concede the shoplifting. Nobody, neither defense nor the court, has articulated what the prejudice is of the jurors hearing that Mr. Abdi committed prior shopliftings. In those circumstances, there's no manifest necessity. And defense counsel has that ability to, in that moment, change strategy and say, look, we'd like to go forward. That's exactly what occurred in Long.
But counsel, you would also agree, though, that defense counsel, after the court makes its kind of record as it relates to the mistrial, it gives both defense counsel and the state the opportunity to respond. It asks, is there anything further? And defense counsel at that time didn't object and make a record as it relates to why the court shouldn't move forward. Is that a fair assessment of what occurred here too?
I think that may be a fair reading of the transcripts, but in that situation, I don't think defense counsel is under the the Olson tells us that there's no obligation to object, and the lack of an objection alone isn't enough to show consent or acquiescence. And Hunter and Long also support this view, is that what's really critical is that defense attorney propose an alternative. He did that. His alternative was rejected. The court said, does anybody have a motion? Okay, I'm doing it on my own. I'm declaring the mistrial. And at that point, defense counsel is not under any obligation to keep re-raising the issue that the courts already ruled against him on. And then, later he brings a motion to dismiss, based on double jeopardy grounds, and that motion is heard in, I believe, February of the following year of 2022. And at that hearing, he submits that motion and says that he has no additional evidence to bring, and that was submitted to the court. So I believe that, he preserved, he showed and preserved his lack of consent by providing that alternative.
Thank you, counsel. I do see that your time has expired. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. With that, counsel for the state respondent, you can begin when you are ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Megan Kelly, and I represent the respondent in this case, the state of Minnesota. The reality of this case is that there were issues with the trial that necessitated and fully supported the district court's decision to sua sponte declare a mistrial. And at the same time, the issues in this case did not rise to the level of indicating intentionality or gross negligence by the prosecutor. Based on that, the state is requesting that the district court's decisions be affirmed and this appeal should be denied. With that, I would welcome any questions from the court.
Help me understand from the case law or the facts of this case, where do we draw the line between a prosecutor's negligent failure to properly or adequately prepare its witnesses versus their intentional failure to do so?
And Your Honor, in this case, the transcript is clear. We actually have a number of occasions where they're discussing, telling the witnesses what the court's ruling was. So there is kind of a fine line when you have to look at the facts of the case between the state and the court finds the state did prepare its witnesses, met with them and explained the court's rulings and kind of the free will of the witnesses when they're on the stand that the state can't necessarily control.
However,
And
counsel, what about a situation like here where it's not just the witness's behavior, but it's a video in which the state had a clear ruling from the court regarding prior bad acts? That video, the statement made by the officer in the video, is clearly a reference to the prior bad act. The state, it would seem to me, and I believe the court kind of articulated this with their frustration at the end, that at bare minimum, the state should have reviewed that video, identified that statement, and mitigated any bad act, prior bad act, through redacting it, and did not. So what is the difference, and where do we draw the line between, for example, where it is a witness, and quite frankly, you may not be able to always control what a witness says on the stand, versus a video that the state has full control of and could have easily redacted, but did not in this case, in light not only of the court's ruling, but the court's ruling and previous violations of that ruling? It seemed like there was a heightened sense here at this point that you didn't just have the court saying no prior acts, you had the court saying no prior acts, and you had repeated violations of those prior bad acts by witnesses And then the state offers a video that it completely controlled and could have mitigated through redacting, but did not. Why should we not find that that is more than is intentional?
And Your Honor, looking at the facts of this case, that video, I mean, obviously violated the court's ruling. It should not have come in as evidence. But frankly, both sides viewed the video and it was just a mistake. It should not have come in, but it does not rise to the level of gross negligence. And in this case in particular, I think the attorney for Mr. Abdi makes a record about the difficulty that they're having keeping the cases straight because he has 36 open files that the defense attorney is representing him on. And so, while that clearly was a mistake, that video should not have come in. It does not rise to the level of gross negligence given the facts of this case. And when you're looking at the cumulative effect of the information that came in, the court references four instances of evidence coming in that should not have. And the first was with the officer Dan Hoff's testimony. And it's respondent's position that that did not violate the court order. Officer Dan Hoff testified that he knew Mr. Abdi from prior interactions. He did not indicate what those prior interactions were. And in fact, the prosecutor in this case indicated to the court on the record that he intended to ask the witnesses how they knew Mr. Abdi. Obviously, identity is a relevant part of any case that the state is required to prove. And when it's a burglary case like this, where trespass is the underlying basis for the non-consent, the state has to prove that the individual who was trespassed was the individual who later returned to the store. And so the court and defense counsel was aware that the state was intending to ask the witnesses, Mr. Harder and Officer Dan Hoff, how they knew Mr. Abdi. And Officer Dan Hoff's information that he provided after that question did not violate the court order. Looking at the next two instances that came out in the Harder testimony, obviously, when Mr. Harder testified that he knew Mr. Abdi from a prior shoplifting incident, that was a violation of the court order. But again, when looking at the questions, they were similar to the ones asked of Officer Dan Hoff, in that it's clear the state was attempting to elicit information regarding identity that Mr. Harder knew Mr. Abdi, recognized him, and recognized he was an individual trespassed from the store. So, when looking at those two instances, the Dan Hoff testimony did not violate the court order. The information brought in by Mr. Harder was not intentional by the state. It was similar questions that were asked of Officer Dan Hoff and indicated previously that the state was going to ask. And the third instance in the Harder testimony was elicited by the defense attorney. So that cannot be attributed to the state. So when we're looking at the cumulative effect here, really the only two things that came in that truly violated the court order that could plausibly be attributed to the state is that first statement by David Harder indicating that he knew Mr. Abdi from a prior trespass or a prior shoplifting and the body camera that came in. And it's respondent's position that those two mistakes, arguably the first one, the state, it shows that it was not intentional based on the Dan Hoff testimony and the similarity in the questions. But those two instances do not rise to the low level of gross negligence and certainly do not indicate intentionality by the prosecutor.
Counsel, how do you respond to appellant's argument that the district court's review of the right before the mistrial was granted, that the district court failed to balance options? For instance, this proposal to have the officer correct the record as to the statement that came out in the video.
And our respondent fully disagrees with the position put on the record by appellant. When looking at the transcript and what the district court actually said, it's clear that the district court did consider this alternative. Defense counsel proposed that the officer testify something to the effect that he was there investigating the shoplifting at Walmart and not cash-wise. And the district court expressed that she was concerned the officer would not be able to truthfully do so, despite the prosecutor disagreeing with that and thinking the officer could. The district court obviously did not agree because the district court then went on to make a very lengthy record about how justice required her to declare a mistrial in this case. And so, looking at the totality of that interaction, it is clear that the district court considered that and then ruled that it essentially was not sufficient. It would not protect Mr. Abdi's rights to allow the officer to clarify that testimony.
What about the suggestion, and maybe I misheard, but that the state or the state's attorney, the prosecuting attorney at the time, though, agreed that this was a matter that could be corrected, that the statement about the cash-wise trespassing was made erroneously and the officer could correct it.
And although the district court does not expressly make a record about why she feels that's inadequate, the prosecutor's statements clearly did not change the district court's mind. The district court expressed hesitancy and concern about the adequacy of the proposal made by the defense attorney, allowed the state to respond, and then went on to declare a mistrial. Based on the totality of that interaction, it's clear that the district court did not find that proposal adequate. Your Honor, seeing no further questions from the court, it's respondent's position that the district court did appropriately exercise its discretion in declaring a mistrial in this case. The mistrial was warranted by a manifest necessity, and a record was clearly made regarding the necessity. And the prosecutor did not intentionally or through gross negligence cause this mistrial. Therefore, double jeopardy would not attach, and this appeal should be dismissed in its entirety. And I would cede the rest of my time if there are no further questions from the court.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. McGinnis, you will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal, and you can begin when you are ready.
Thank you. And just to respond to the issue of intentionality, this is we're dealing with multiple violations of the not different court orders, but the same court order regarding the mention of the prior bad act. So the prosecutor is repeatedly violating the same instruction. That instruction was given to the prosecutor multiple times when in the motions in limine discussion, the court almost foresees the problem that's going to arise with the Walmart employees' testimony. And the court specifically tells the prosecutor to make sure that I believe it's on page 12 of the first trial transcript. Specifically tells the prosecutor at that moment to prepare your witness and make sure that they don't mention the past bad acts. Then there's a second warning that happens right before the Walmart employee is to testify. That's on page 96 and 97 of the trial transcript, where the court again, is essentially holding the prosecutor's hand, telling him to admonish your witness, prepare them, make sure they don't mention these past bad acts. And instead of what the prosecutor said in motions in limine, that he would ask if they were familiar, if the witnesses were familiar with Mr. Abdi, the prosecutor asks the Walmart employee, "How do you know Mr. Abdi?" And so and that is what elicits the Walmart employee statement, that's blatantly in violation of the court order. And then that's only the sort of the midpoint of these problems that occur in this trial. Even after that, and after the Walmart's employees' continued statements during cross-examination to in response to a question that doesn't call for any background on Mr. Abdi. The question is, what did you say to Mr. Abdi? Which was absolutely within the realm of that was the focus of the defense, was Mr. Abdi's language ability, and what was said to him was highly relevant to that. The Walmart employee again launches into the prior bad acts. So we have multiple admonitions before the misconduct, and then we have, even after that, we have multiple instances of misconduct. And what Organ v. Kennedy says is, and Justice Powell says in that case, is to look at the record, and that this is something that courts do, is that we look at the record to determine intentionality. And here we have multiple admonitions followed by multiple violations, all of the same court order. And it's a court order that the prosecutor walked into the trial thinking he would be able to present this evidence. It was his belief that the evidence of the prior shopliftings were intrinsic evidence to the burglary crime. He wanted to get this information in. The court ruled against him, and then he repeatedly violated that order based despite multiple admonitions. So that, I think, on this record is intentional conduct, and it far surpasses the misconduct that courts have addressed before in Fuller and Schroper and Nolasco Solanic. I think we have something far beyond what we've seen before. And this and in the first Fuller case that this court addressed, this court applied the gross negligence resulting in a mistrial standard. And I think that's what, if we're not seeing intentional misconduct, we're certainly seeing gross negligence resulting in a mistrial, all caused by the prosecutor. Okay. If there's no questions, I'll cede the remaining time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your argument today, as well as your briefing. It was very helpful. This matter is submitted, and we will issue an order, an opinion within the statutory time frame. With that, that does conclude today's oral argument calendar. We will now conclude and discuss our fourth non-oral argument calendar as well. Thank you both, and you are free to go.